Welcome to In the Stacks, brought to you by the Lewistown Public Library in Lewistown, Montana, a podcast about the wide and wild world of libraries.
Great. Well, today we have Dave Casario.
Perfect.
And Bill Kamowski.
That's right.
To chat with us about Montana and writing and what they do. So let's just maybe start with some introductions here. I'm, of course, Alyssa, you know me.
And I'm Dave Casario, and I'm a poet and a performer.
Hi, I'm Bill Kamowski, and I'm a professor at MSU Billings, and I teach English when they let me. I teach Shakespeare and Chaucer and things medieval. And I also teach mythology, which I'm convinced nobody else is qualified to teach, nor am I.
So where are you both from? I mean, I'm from Ekalaka.
Well, I grew up in the south side of Chicago, and I always wanted to come from a place like Ekalaka. You know, because I always loved the West as a kid growing up. And I grew up in the industrial south side of Chicago, and my father was a steel worker. And I used to talk to him regularly as a kid. I would pester the heck out of him, going, when are we moving to Montana? Mm-hmm. Right? I said, well, quit your job and we'll move to Montana. You know. And in my mind, it was anywhere west, but it was Montana because my grandfather was an Italian immigrant. And, well, he was born in America, but just barely. And he always said he was born in Butte, Montana. He would just tell us just these beautiful stories about how beautiful Butte was. You know, he thought of it the Alps. This is around 1910, right? And so the pit wasn't there then. And he just had this whole thing. And so we always wanted to go out west. And my dad was like, I've got a job, and I've got three kids, and I'm not moving. Oh, and I got a wife, too. So, you know, so I always wanted to come out west and never thought I'd get to live in Montana. But around 2003, I was able to come out here and live, and it's one of the best places I've ever lived in, you know, and I've lived all over the country, so, yeah.
I'm Bill, and I grew up in New Jersey. I do miss New York in one way. In another way, I found myself on the west side of New Jersey in the Appalachian Trail, walking the hills when I could on weekends. I ended up going to graduate school at Washington State and taking my degree there. And when I did have my degree, I found a job at Billings, at what was then Eastern Montana College, now Montana State University Billings. And I've had my career there and have enjoyed it very much. I find myself, hopefully this year as well, in the Beartooth Mountains, hiking nearby. We hope it will be open again after those floods. We're somewhat concerned about it, and especially about the people up there, who we've come to know to some extent. But so I basically think of myself now as from Montana, but with attachments.
From Montana with attachments. Yeah. I like that. What was the best thing when you got to Montana at first? And what was the thing that hit you as just entirely strange?
Well, one of the coolest things for me about being in Billings was I was living in Seattle for 10 years before I came out to Billings. And I would have friends visit from Seattle. And of course, you know, Billings to Seattle is generally Alaska Airlines and it's one flight horizon. Mm-hmm. And so if you get on that plane, anybody coming to, you know, to Billings, you're coming straight to Billings. You're not, you know, going off somewhere else. And so friends would sit there and they'd say, yeah, I was talking to somebody on the plane. And they said, what are you doing here? And he goes, well, I'm going to visit my friend Dave Casario. They go, oh, yeah, I know Dave. You know? And so he's like, everybody, they go, what, you know, everybody? And you walk down the street, and in Billings, even though it's 100,000 people, but, I mean, I lived in the west side of New York, and Hell's Kitchen, there was more people on my block than there were in Seattle, it felt like. I mean, in Billings, that it's still a small town feel to it. Mm-hmm. And I imagine Lewistown is, as you were saying, is perhaps even more so. So that was the coolest thing.
Neat.
Well, that's the advantage and disadvantage of living in Billings, although it is becoming a bigger city, so to speak, that you're known and not known. Both of them can be good at various times. But I think when I moved to Billings, I thought the space was grand to have it all around you, in the sense of the open space. I enjoyed the people, they were friendly, I think to some extent more friendly than you'd find in an urban culture, although I find some exceptions about New York, mm-hmm. and especially in recent years. But I guess the thing that I didn't care for about Billings when we moved there was that we couldn't find a good restaurant, except for one, Vinny's.
Vinny's,
who had, they had the best marinara and the best pasta dishes you could find almost anywhere. We had trouble with hamburgers at times. it's that has all changed. The cuisine is there now, and we enjoy it.
Same thing in Billings. The first one I got there, I mean, I started working in a restaurant and at Bistorenzo, and at that point it was, you know, pretty much the main restaurant, the biggest, you know, the best restaurant in town. I think it's still one of the top mm-hmm. two or three in town. The pickings were a little slim, you know, in some ways. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I also love about Montana is that, I mean, I lived in New York as a poet, working with people there. You know, I went to NYU for my graduate work and stuff, and spent a lot of time there, you know, was teaching back there as well. And then being in Seattle. But in Montana, it's a bit like Ireland in a way, because the poets and the writers, fiction writers, mm-hmm. everybody kind of knows everybody. Mm-hmm. If you go to Seattle, you have a lot of cliques. You might know people, but there's these are the parameters for this group. These are the parameters for that mm-hmm. group. And New York is just too big, so it isn't necessarily that people are carving out their space. But here, you know, I mean, Tammy Holland, former Montana Poet Laureate, fantastic poet. I got to meet her when I first moved to Billings, and she was just, hey, you're a poet. Glad to meet you. Mm-hmm. You know, here's every, you know, I'm going to introduce you to people. And the same thing still, you know, I mean, I mean, we have a network of just knowing people across the state. You know? So I like that, and it's very open and very forthcoming. People don't seem to be fighting over perceived territory or what belongs to somebody. Mm-hmm. It's like we're out in the middle of the West. Both coasts don't know we exist as literary centers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that's the thing I like about it. You can do a lot of things out here.
Well, yeah, I guess in a way I agree with David, although I don't think of myself as primarily a writer, but rather as a teacher. But you seem to be able to bump into more writers out here, as in published and accomplished writers, you know, person for person, than elsewhere. It seems that, you know, Montana has drawn them. Billings is one town. Oh, Livingston would be another, mm-hmm. for sure. Yeah. Certainly Livingston. But that's been refreshing. And this House of Books, the co-op bookstore downtown in Billings, has X number. I think there are maybe 20 writers behind that or so.
Yeah.
Something to that effect, yeah. who have a share in it. It's really quite an interesting place to go to.
I don't think I've ever been. I'm going to have to go.
Yeah. It's right downtown.
And when they're going to move 2 weeks from now, pardon me, they'll be changing location. Still downtown, but just around the block mm-hmm. in a bigger, or in a better space, mm-hmm. One that's mm-hmm. more useful for them. And there's this, you know, this House of Books, and of course Livingston has Oak River Books, which is a fan. If you've never been to, you've got a next trip to Livingston, Elk River Books. Yeah, you got to go there. Stop in and say hello to Mark Bodine and and Andrea Peacock. So yeah.
Yes, and we're looking for more activities now that the plague is subsiding.
Oh gosh,
there have always been so many activities, from children's activities with puzzles and picture books and so forth,
into
adult activities, like just something, for example, that I co-hosted with another member down there, the Jane Austen Day, for instance. It's a whole breadth of interest that will attract people. And Dave reading his own poetry, which is really quite something to hear.
Yeah, because the cool thing about Billings is that, I mean, I've always worked, you know, you said you have comparative literature, you know, as your degree, and I've always sort of been a comparative artist or a collaborator. I love, you know, working, to me, poetry is an oral art. And so the orality of poetry predates literacy, of course. And so your poet could equally be a musician, could be a performer, could be a dancer or a mover, all incorporating, you know, spoken language, even though it would be written down. And so I like working with them. And the other thing is that if I work with some really good musicians in Billings, Parker Brown, for example, and Alex Nallman, who's a fantastic guitarist as well, and Eric Olson, if you ever get to hear him play piano, you know, we can get up on stage and work poetry and jazz together. And not just someone reading in a background. It's interactive art. And we can charge, you know, $25-$30 for a house concert or something like that. And people come out and drink and have a good time. And they're coming out for poetry and music. Whereas if normally you've seen poetry readings, maybe 20 people show up, right? But we can, you know, get 100 people in there having a good time. So you can make a living doing poetry. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, Dave, about poetry being an oral art, because now I don't have to harp on it. You're taking care of that very nicely.
Exactly. Well, it's nice to hear it.
It is. Yeah. I mean, poetry was around before we could read and write.
So I am fascinated by people who can read in Old English and Middle English with the correct pronunciation, and you... Do both of you do that?
Bill is much more accomplished than myself. I took a class theoretically with Jess Bessinger Jr. At NYU in my graduate time there. And I barely got through that course. But what I really liked was the sound of the language, because it takes me back to the roots. I just kept with it. And then I was one of the producers of the Poetry Slam in Seattle. And I said, okay, we're kind of like oral, you know, they're trying to do oral poetry in a way that they've got some of that format to it. I'll just memorize some Beowulf and come up and do it at the Dead Poets Slam. they won't have a clue what's going on. And so I sort of take it and make it theater. And I do take some liberties, which Bill knows. But Bill, I'm going to turn that part over to you about knowing the language.
Well, I've studied Old English. I confess and lost it, like when you don't do your French all the time, back to it and gained it 1, 2, and 3 times. But this is my third time around. Chaucer was, for the longest time, my favorite writer. But I have to say, one of the things I did get inspiration from, and much more briefly than you did, was from Jess Bessinger. I heard him perform at a medieval conference where he simply wrapped up an audience of 200 literature professors in his performance of the Old English poem, The Wanderer. The languages are wonderful. Old English, Middle English, which is Old English plus the French, plus many other languages that come across the sea to it. And that caught me early on in my graduate studies, and I just pursued it and ended up writing my dissertation on Chaucer, which, and I don't want to get into that, but which talked about Chaucer as a person who wrote both for the book and to be heard aloud.
That's fascinating. I love this idea of poetry as an oral art, and thinking about when we did our poetry episode for this podcast, we talked about how so much of that gets lost between the writer and the intonations and accents they have. And the reader, I think that's a really fascinating sort of thing with poetry, how, I mean, we talked a little about Irish poetry and that. Is that language, no, English in an Irish accent sounds so completely different. It's just funny to think about how what things transfer and what things don't.
Well, it's funny because the idea, I mean, Bill will talk about this when we do the presentation tonight, about how the vowels change. I took the Old English at NYU because I wanted to go back in the sound of language and as much as I could understand it and feel it. But I also had, my mother, she was English. She was, Northern English up close to Liverpool, up in by Warrington, along the Mersey. And so there's a lot of confluence of different dialects in there and accents. And when she came over to America, I know, even though I can't remember it, she still had all the accent and all the different mannerisms and rhythms and things like that. And I know that as a kid I absorbed it because she was a great storyteller to kids, and she would just tell us stories. So until she began to say, I'm sticking out because I have this accent. And, you know, if you were to have met her any point after the time I was probably 4, she sounded like she's from Chicago. She was just horrible. So later when she was able to go back, she'd come back picking up the accent again, but then she'd lose it real quick. So I think those sounds, you know, carry with us in some ways.
And I hope we can retain them too. But what's happening with a lot of the dialects in the British Isles is, of course, that modern media, they're flattening out and they're becoming more regular in terms of a standard way of saying things. Whereas I can recall that this goes back 40 years, I guess. My wife and I were on a bus going from Carlisle up into Scotland. And there were two ladies in front of us talking, and we took the local bus because we wanted the local color. And they were talking, apparently both of them in English, but we could only understand one of them. The other one, it could have been from anywhere as far as we knew, but in fact it was a dialect. I think that would be harder to find today.
Yeah.
I hope we've not lost it all, but I guess I'll just have to take another tour of the countryside to see what I can find.
Even in America, you know, the United States, you know, we same thing, we're losing a lot of that too, I think. And I know a friend of mine, Owner Gritz, she just had an article, I don't know if it was in the New York Times, but it was just talking about her accent from being in New York and so how she began to lose it. And I remember that people would say, where are you from? I'm from Chicago. And they go, you don't have a Chicago accent. And I don't, except every so often, some part of it will come out and I don't even know that it's there. But then I go back to Chicago and it's such a cosmopolitan city and everything that people, unless you were really born there, you don't really have that anymore, right? Mm-hmm. You get the caricatures of Da Bears and all that kind of silly stuff. Yeah. But so I like this, hearing, just, you know, traveling around the country. You go down south or you go up to New England or Maine or different, you know, but even Montanans have accents.
Oh, we do.
You know, but you don't think about it. Then you go somewhere else and they're going, you got an accent. No, I don't.
So interesting, though. I feel like a lot of that in Montana is gendered. Like, my mom and my dad sound very differently. Because my mom, I don't know, my dad, farmer and rancher and super smart, and I'll go back and forth in between those two accents. And we've talked about that a lot, my mom and I have, about how that works here and how that works even, like, within a county. People who live in Ikalaka sound very different than people in the South County.
Yeah.
Speaking of family, in my wife's family, her father had a flatter accent that was closer to what an American newscaster would have. Right. Her mother had a very clear Jersey accent, or let's say New York accent, if you want to just put it all together. My wife grew up with the flatter newscaster accent, and her older brother and younger sister grew up with the Jersey accent.
So can you do a Jersey accent?
Not really. Not really. I couldn't do it, no. I'd have to be on Thoit Street. Or that's closer to Brooklyn, I don't know.
Can you do a real strong Chicago accent?
No, I can't. No. Though I do have on my CD where I'm doing a piece and I shift into that. Mm-hmm. And it just because of the street person's voice, but not intentionally.
No.
I would end up doing the caricature that I get from the old Saturday Night Live from the 70s, you know, Belushi and those guys. No. I can't do it. Don't even want to try to embarrass, go, you're not from Chicago.
I just love hearing everyone's different accents and intonations and all of that, because it's so much of a story in and of itself. Yeah. I love now that we have things like recordings and you can go back and listen to poets from more recent times, read some of their work. And speaking of that, Dave, you have some books you pulled out.
No, these aren't mine, but before we get to those, I just want to, on the same subject, the thing that also really I enjoyed when I moved to New York back in 83. So I lived there, and one of the coolest things about New York was walking down the street, we're talking about different voices, and you know how crowded New York is. And all of a sudden you have these different voices, not just speaking English, but speaking other languages, different rates of speech. And then, of course, you have people that are, you know, that was the 80s back when AIDS was really full-blown, and you would also have a lot of the funding went out for mental health care. And so a lot of people had mental disabilities and were on the street and homeless. So you would hear all sorts of different types of speech patterns and mm-hmm. consciousness behind mm-hmm. them. And it made me think, I was revisiting Walt Whitman at that point, and suddenly mm-hmm. I'm going, this is Whitman, mm-hmm. 100 years or so later, mm-hmm. and walking down the street, and he's just doing the same thing. And then, of course, I went, oh, then I started remembering Shakespeare. Shakespeare was in the Cosmopolitan London, mm-hmm. probably doing the same thing.
And we do assume that, of course, Shakespeare's company did not all come from London. And so they probably had various accents. And to try and reconstruct Shakespeare's English for its sound is a tentative kind of thing, to say the least.
The sound and the writing, with all of the different folios and quartos and all of the different versions of all of the plays.
Yeah, there's that. One thing about what Dave was saying, I think, there are the whole many, many blocks in Midtown Manhattan and downtown Manhattan, where if you walk around the block and you don't hear four different languages, you probably haven't been listening.
True. But I think money-wise, it's probably being pushed to the outer boroughs now. But
yeah, well, there's that.
Yeah, you can't afford to live, But when I lived there, I paid $265 a month for rent.
You might be able to get a parking space for a week on a discount there.
Yeah.
It was great. It was in Hell's Kitchen, and it was a 5-floor walk up, but I could afford to live there, mm-hmm. and it was rent controlled. So, rent control. Mm-hmm. You understand? That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. No, but the reason I brought these in is because of just different projects that are Montana grown. The first is more local. I work with a group called Young Poets. And we work with 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders in the Billings area, mostly Title I schools. We basically do a 12-week course with them. We come in once a week with the poets, and they write poetry. They do 10 lessons of writing poetry. Not really sort of lessons, or more, here's an idea, and then they write. And then at the end, we do a little bit of revision. They pick their favorite poem, and then we put together little anthologies by theirs. Yeah.
And they're little spiral bounds.
Exactly, spiral bound. And we pretty much keep it close to what they want. We'll fix the spelling and those kinds of things. And we were finally able to get back in because we had pretty much 2 years off with COVID, not being able to get into the schools. And it's amazing, this particular time coming back, the amount of writing about very deeply personal stuff that you would not think a 5th or a 4th grader would open up about. And I think the last couple of years has affected mm-hmm. students quite a bit in terms of their emotional, inner emotional life. And of course, being able to write poetry, and we give them free rein, right? One of our things is poets don't make mistakes, they just change their minds. So there's no right or wrong way to go about doing it. And once they finally believe that I'm telling them the truth and that there's no right answer, then they really open up in ways that, I got to watch the tears sometimes, And then the other program that I'm working with is called I Am Montana, and it's Student Reflections on Identity and Place. And I work at the Career Center, which pulls students from all 3 high schools in Billings. And I work with Wanda Morales, the teacher there. And so we're one part of the program. Anywhere from 9th graders to 12th graders will be in these volumes. We work with Freeverse up in Mount Missoula. And they work with incarcerated youth that are incarcerated or under care around the state, and different correctional facilities, and those teachers pull in the books, and then after the end of our 10-week or 8-week session, we compile, the poems from them, and this is where we've got 3 volumes out for 3 years in a row, and then a 4th one's coming out probably in September sometime. And those students are just fantastic too, because they don't sign up, at least with the Career Center, to write poetry. They're in the class. The teacher's like, this is part of what you're going to be doing for the next 8 weeks. And we just push them. And suddenly they find this ability, to express themselves. And we've gotten some nice reviews. They use this book at, they use it over at University of Montana in some of the different classes. And I don't know. I've got to actually look to see to get the right one in there. And so we've got some nice reviews. The Montana Quarterly has reviewed this. And we're getting a great deal more attention to this combination, because it's for the voices that you don't hear, in prisons and in other places like that. And I don't want to use the word prison because it's more incarceration. It might just be under care. But then, of course, compare the same age group, teenagers in that situation and then teenagers who are not incarcerated. Mm-hmm. But the experiences, the overlap is really interesting because the interior life is still very similar. So I just wanted to give a plug for those books. And you can get those books at this House of Books and pretty much anywhere.
That's great.
Then I'm going to donate these to the library.
Thank you.
Cool. Those two. So, yeah.
I love these poems from the kids. They're just... They're so wonderful.
Yeah, there's actually some like, oh, that's nice, but I'm like, ooh, that's actually really.
Can I read one?
That's fine. It'd be great to.
It's My Mind is Made of Cheese by Lily S. So, my mind is made of cheese. Then my mind is the moon. The moon is made from rock. So, then is my mind rock? Did I live under a rock? I don't think so, because I'm smart. But probably not, because I'm weird. So my mind is made from cheese. I love that! And I'm very curious as to... Because both of you read and perform. I mean, being a college professor is all about that, I feel like. And mm-hmm. so is being a poet. Yeah. Do you want to try to read the same poem and just see how it's different between people? Because I'm very curious as to how... You two would read this one, or a different one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that one, sure.
My mind is made of cheese. Then my mind is the moon. The moon is made from rock. So then is my mind rock? Did I live under a rock? I don't think so, because I'm smart. But probably not because I'm weird. So my mind is made of cheese.
Okay, cool. I think that's... My mind is made of cheese. My mind is made of cheese. Then my mind is the moon. The moon is made from rock. So then is my mind rock? Did I live under a rock? I don't think so. Because I'm smart. But probably not because I'm weird. So my mind is made from cheese.
It's just so fascinating to get different people too.
Different people, and probably if you gave it to, I don't know about you, I won't speak for you, Dave, but if you gave it to me again to read, I wouldn't read it the same way. Yeah.
So how does that work for you too, and what you do and what you teach?
Well, obviously it's better when you're familiar with the poem as opposed to here when you see it for the very first time, although there are advantages there as well, but... Knowing the poem, I think once you get in front of a group of faces and you just look at them for how they're listening or what kind of listeners they might be, I think it makes you adjust every time. Even though your eyes end up on the page, much of the time you wind up looking at a different profile and speaking to a different profile. You think it's you, I think it's me doing it, but I'm not sure that... to what extent I'm manipulating it and to what extent the audience is, in a good sense, manipulating my reading of it. And that may depend on how much eye contact you can spend with an audience and how much you can't.
Yeah. It's funny because I memorize a lot of poetry. Just and poetry, of course, slows you down. Right. I mean, you know, of course, mm-hmm. that you give a student a poem and they'll race through it as fast as they can, if they can read, or if they stumble, one of the two, most of the time. But if they begin to slow down, they start to think a little bit about it. They start to recognize the different mm-hmm. breath patterns that we try to notate by line lengths, by punctuation, simply by the way vowels and consonants fall within a word, right, depending on our sensitivity to that. And that, to me, is like a musical score. There's a certain set there, but there's a lot of interplay with it, mm-hmm. too, as well. Mm-hmm. And I notice that a lot when I'm working, because I know the poems that I've written. Mm-hmm. So I know these poems, I've almost memorized just from having worked on them so long. But then I'll get up and working, let's say I'm working with the full band, and it'll change it, because suddenly I want to extend this vowel, or I hear this vowel in a different way, or this phrase is this. And I think a really good poem... is a it has that flexibility. I mean, you could take, you know, you could take Lake Isle of Innisfree by Yeats. I mean, you can read it the way, it, but there's all this room for it. As a matter of fact, he reads it in lots of different ways. I mean, he reads it in a bardic sort of way, one of his recordings. He's like, I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree in a small cabin, build there, you know, and he's just, and he, you know, he's just doing it that way. And then he's just read it. He's like, I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree. You know, he's done it that way too, right? But the reason he did it was, you're laughing because there's the, you know, there's the laughing reason, but he also says, I also mean it seriously the way I'm reading it. You know, he wasn't just pulling your leg, unless you know differently about that.
The way you first recited the first couple of lines is not the way I read it. I hear it as a very quiet poem, and that's why I was laughing. And then you turn around and say that our poet likewise hears it as a quiet poem, as well as a bardic kind of poem.
And well, that I'm got it because I mean, there's recordings of him reading it much better than the way I did it, but with that same elongated, you know, oratorical, almost stentorian voice. And he means it because it comes from that idea of language having power. I mean, if you go to like a lot of oral poetry, there's a, one great poem from, well, I'll think of the name of it, but it's the idea that poetry has power and words have power. That in ancient sort of Irish poetry, you used to have the bards with the warriors, and they would just yell curses in poetry back and forth, or blessings, you know, or whatever. You know, of course, if they got hit with a broadsword or a big warhammer, it ain't going to work either. But the idea of language having power in that way, and I think that, that he can pull the, we went back to sound, the idea of pulling sounds out of the vocalization that we can do. I mean, martial arts uses vocalization in certain things, you know, for striking power and for breath and everything. So I think the idea of voice, that Yeats would say, I'm serious about this, but but you can read it and you know that it's a quiet poem in that way. You know, so he did it that way. So so that's how I feel about that stuff.
Yeah, and I think what you say about poetry, you could extend just to writing itself with the students who aren't poets, who are the majority. And you ask them, especially struggling ones, well, what voice do you hear when you read this? What voice do you hear when you wrote this? And if they say none, you know that's where the trouble is and where they need to start, because they don't really have a feel for language that could make them as efficient a writer or as, shall we say, sharp a writer as they could be.
I love what you're doing with having the kids write. And I suppose part of that is performance, too. I think poetry is such a good reminder for students, especially, of how people approach the same things differently. I think we lose some of that sometimes.
We do lose it. Children have it. I brought it in many times to class, but Archibald MacLeish's Art of Poetry, Ars Poetica. And I brought that in to class. It was a freshman college literature class, you know, introduction to literature. And that day, and I always allowed it, a mother student brought into class her 11-year-old daughter and played this one just strictly Socratically, letting the students answer as many questions as they could about it that I might throw to them. Right, it's the poem that ends with a poem, contradictorily, a poem should not mean but be, which is, you know, instantly contradictory, but at any rate, and eventually, Socratically, things break down, nobody else is answering questions except for one person in the room, who was, of course, the 11-year-old, who was a guest.
What's your favorite poem to teach?
I couldn't narrow that down entirely. But if we just want to talk about poems that are about poems, like The Art of Poetry, maybe Wallace Stevens' The Motive for Metaphor, where he talks about what we like about metaphor and poetry is its incompleteness. It's not all there. In the same way, you were happy in spring with the half colors of quarter things. It ends with a resistance to the vital, fatal, arrogant, dominant X, where X equals something exactly. And metaphor is, you know, delightfully imperfect and incomplete.
Yeah.
That's one of the poems I love to teach. So.
One of my favorite poems about poetry like that is Elizabeth Bishop's Sistina.
Oh yeah,
it's all structured around. It's just a lovely kind of meditation on how words and symbols and images work, I think. But do you have a favorite poem to work with in these classes you do, Dave?
No, I don't. Not off the top of my head. I'll probably walk out and go, oh, mm-hmm. I should use that one. I don't have a particular one specific poem for, you know, the Eye of Montana or for the third or fourth, fifth graders. Mm-hmm. Don't. And it's almost like saying, you know, do I have a favorite poet? Like, oh, gosh, no. there's ones I come back to. And, you know, I said, but you'll be living dead the last 20 years. when? Yeah, no, I don't. We're going to get close to time, but I'm going to give three books that I would recommend that influence me, and not poetry. So I'll do that for my sign-off, because I actually wrote those down. I think The Gift by Lewis Hyde, and there's a subtitle to it, but The Gift by Lewis Hyde. And then The Great War and Modern Memory, and I don't know, I think it's Fussell wrote it. And then the other one is Praises and Dispraises, Poetry and Politics in the 20th Century. And I don't know why I cannot remember the author's name. But those were three influential books for me right around in the 1980s, early 90s, that just made me go, oh, I've been wanting to write and talk about these things. And suddenly they opened up ideas. I mean, I had a lot of the ideas, especially The Gift. I understood the basic premise by doing theater, but he articulated it. And I said, oh, he put it into words what I understood instinctually and through experience, but could not explain very well to anyone. So those are three books that are still around. The Gift by Lewis Hyde, The Great War and Modern Memory, because the First World War is still with us, both politically and literature. And then also Praises and Dispraises. Terence Despress, I think, wrote that. Mm-hmm. So didn't mean to put you on that spot, but I don't have a favorite poem to teach her.
And I don't either. Yeah. And I guess I'm going to maybe suggest something else, which is kind of where my mind is at the moment. One of the things I'd encourage people to do, whatever it is, and some of it's really bad, but is to read more comedy.
I love comedy.
Yeah.
90% of all the books that get great reviews, and I'm, you know, fudging this percentage number, are of a tragic tone. And to me, it's much harder to write comedy than tragedy. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why Shakespeare survives, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he had that comic touch. Chaucer, likewise, is all over the board, from comic to tragic to Essays in Disguise and the Canterbury Tales. But that's something I think we ought to think more about, is the situation of comedy in writing today.
When you were giving your three books, I was thinking of what my three would be right now. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite ones that I just found here and I'm rereading is Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Oh,
by Tom Stoppard. That's a comedy. I mean, kind of a tragic comedy, like that fabulous line in Hamlet that just goes over all the genres. But that would be my recommendation.
Oh, that's a wonderful thing. My first encounter with that was actually a college production of it. That was great. That brought me to the book, actually. But that, you know, college production could just pop out at you and say, somebody knew what to do with Shakespeare. And I'm not sure, as a teacher of Shakespeare, I've ever really known.
I read it. We did a whole unit, a whole quarter on Hamlet. And it was one of our weeks for that quarter, was that play. Mm-hmm. And it was so fabulous to have it in that context. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all for listening, and thank you, Dave and Bill, for joining us today. It's been wonderful to chat.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Ta-da, that's it.
In the Stacks is produced by the staff at the Lewistown Public Library in Lewistown, Montana. Subscribe to In the Stacks on Spotify, Google, and all other major podcast platforms. Follow us at LPL Graham on Instagram or Lewistown Public Library on Facebook for the latest updates on library happenings, including the podcast. If you have an idea for an episode or a topic you would like us to explore, email us at lewistownpubliclibrary@gmail.com. Thank you for supporting the library.